Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us today. It's quite likely that you or someone you care about is trying to cope with what we're talking about today, hearing loss. Maybe your mom is always saying, speak up, stop mumbling. Or a coworker keeps asking you to repeat what you just said. Or you find yourself telling your husband, I can hear you, but I can't quite make out what you're saying. Hearing loss tends to creep up on people, but it's widespread and very real. About 1 out of 5 Americans over age 12 has lost enough hearing that communication is difficult. By the time we're in our 70s, 2 out of 3 of us are struggling. As America ages, hearing loss is a problem for more people. And it's not a minor inconvenience. Research pioneered at Johns Hopkins shows that hearing loss correlates with quite a few health problems, including falling, anxiety, depression, and dementia. People who have lost even a little hearing are more likely to develop dementia. And yet, just a fraction of Americans who would benefit from hearing aids wear them. Why don't more Americans seek treatment for their hearing loss? Why are hearing aids so expensive when other kinds of audio technology like cell phones are blossoming? What changes are on the horizon to make hearing aids more accessible? In this hour, we'll explore questions like these with one of the doctors who has led the research I mentioned. Dr. Frank Lin is an associate professor of otolaryngology, the specialty that deals with ears and hearing, as well as geriatric medicine, mental health, and epidemiology. Dr. Lin, welcome to Midday.
Thanks again for having me, Sheila.
I'm really glad that you could join us. You and I first spoke, I think, about 5 years ago, when you had just done research about how widespread hearing loss is. How big a problem is it, and why is that news, or was that news?
Well, you know, I think before we did some early research 5 years ago, a lot of people were relying on data which were based on self-report data, people reporting in big studies whether they had hearing or loss or not. But you can imagine if you analyze data that way, it's sort of encumbered by a lot of bias. I mean, some person may say, oh, I don't have a hearing loss, just that you don't speak clearly, right? So some of the earlier studies we did 5 years ago was taking some existing national data sets that did objective measures of hearing to see objectively if people truly had a hearing impairment which could impact communication. And we looked at that data, right, 5-6 years ago now, we saw that the prevalence was incredibly high, that we literally see the prevalence, the number of people with dementia, number of people with hearing, basically the prevalence doubling at every age decade of life, such that by the time you look at 70-year-olds and up, that about two-thirds, about 2 out of 3 adults over 70 actually has a meaningful hearing impairment.
Meaningful meaning it gets in the way of them
exactly.
Understanding what's going on.
So clinically meaningful in the sense that it's a level of hearing impairment where you'll begin noticing difficulties communicating under anything under less ideal circumstances. So in a busy restaurant, at a bar, in a busy room, for instance, you'll begin noticing that you're missing words, that you have to ask people to repeat themselves, and you're missing parts of the speech sometimes.
And so you gave us the proportion of people over 70, but I'm sure I have some listeners who think 70 is really old. What's it mean for me if I'm in my 30s or 40s?
Right. I can't quote the exact percentage off the top of my head. But by the time you look at it's probably the people in their 30s and 40s, it's still relatively low. I mean, it's on the order maybe 5 or 10% or less. But then it doubles with every almost age decade, which is why that by the time you look at people in their 70s, it's almost like 60% or more.
And then you just said the magic word of some research you did more recently that really grabbed my attention, and that was you looked at the connection between hearing loss and dementia.
Yeah, so you know, Sheila, it's something we discussed a few years ago, and I think the big picture there is that for many years it's been seen as, well, hearing loss is this inevitable and hence must be a relatively inconsequential part of aging. And when you actually look at that sort of assumption, you realize it's not based on science. It's just based on assumption because it's so common. How could it be important? But when we began looking at that several years ago, we actually looked at these large epidemiologic studies that have been following older adults for many, many years. And what we found in these studies was that people with hearing loss, even after controlling and adjusting for things like age and whether they had high blood pressure and diabetes, we saw that hearing loss was clearly associated with a much higher risk of developing cognitive decline and dementia over time.
Cognitive decline means what?
Cognitive decline, so sort of loss of sort of your general thinking and memory abilities, your ability to multitask, your ability to have long-term and short-term memory. But we see those skill sets also sort of declining faster in those with hearing loss versus those without hearing loss.
And you the verb you used, I think, just now is associated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're not saying it's that the hearing loss causes cognitive decline or the hearing loss causes dementia.
Exactly. And I think that's a key distinction is that like many any human study is that these when we do this research, it's based on epidemiology. It's based on taking a lot of people, following them for many years and looking at what's linked with something else. For example, we still probably technically can't say that smoking causes lung cancer, technically speaking, right?
We can't?
Well, I mean, you don't really have experimental studies where you take someone and you say, you smoke, and then you don't smoke, and we see who develops cancer.
I see.
Right? So it's always based on association, per se, right? But, you know, with the strength of evidence across multiple different studies now going back decades, we are pretty clear that smoking causes lung cancer, right? But from an epidemiologic study, when you look at just people and you follow them without experimentally manipulating them, per se, you can never prove something causally with epidemiology. So importantly, when we do an epidemiologic study, though, is that we want to control for things. We want to control for the possible bias of age, for instance, or someone's whether they have diabetes or whether they're more educated. And when we've done these studies in the past, we've adjusted for all these possible confounders, these things that could just lead to a correlation between the two, is we still see a very, very strong link between hearing loss and the risk of dementia.
So what does that say in terms of an intervention? I mean, is there, if you think that the hearing loss plays a role, not just coexists with, but plays a role in cognitive decline or dementia, what can you do about that?
Great. So that is the key public health question, because until then, it's all sort of academic, right? So I think that really is best approach from thinking about, well, why do we even think hearing loss then may be related with someone's risk of dementia? And for that, we think right now, Lisa, there might be three pathways through which hearing loss could actually contribute to a greater risk of dementia over time. One is the idea of cognitive load, the idea that when you can't hear, the main issue is that your brain is constantly receiving a very garbled signal from the ear. So we're understanding now through many studies now is the brain literally has to work harder to process sound when you can't hear as well, right? So there's very much this notion that hearing loss imposes or puts a load on the brain over time, right? A second idea is that when you have much reduced or impoverished auditory input, the signal going from the ear to the brain is much more impoverished and less clear, is that literally leads to possibly faster rates of atrophy over parts of the brain that process sound because you're getting less stimulation there. Importantly,
so they shrink. I mean, physically, that part of your brain shrinks?
Well, that's what we've seen actually in epidemiologic studies. And we follow people's MRI scans for many, many years. And we look at the brains of people on MRI scans, of people who have hearing loss and those who don't. We literally see that parts of the brain atrophy or the volume is shrinking faster than the people who don't have hearing loss. And that makes sense, actually, with some of the animal studies. I've looked at those, too. If you take an animal model and you give it a hearing loss, per se, you see these changes in terms of the brain. So there's very much the idea that hearing loss in and of itself may lead to brain changes in brain structure, which then could lead to changes in terms of brain function, mainly because those parts of the brain that process sound that may be shrinking faster, they're also important not only for sound, but they also subserve other areas of our thinking and memory abilities. And finally, the last idea for how hearing loss could be linked with or possibly helping contribute to the risk of things like dementia is that there's a general notion that if you can't hear as well, you're less likely to be socially engaged. You're not as likely to be active as you would be if you had good hearing, less likely to go out with your friends or be engaged in the conversation. And we've long known now that social engagement and our ability to remain sort of cognitively and physically engaged likely plays a role in the risk of dementia as well. So all those pathways, cognitive load, changes in brain structure, as well as social isolation, all suggest then that, well, theoretically, I should say, is that if we quote-unquote treat hearing loss, that maybe it makes a difference. But it still remains right now a very theoretical notion. And in other words, that trial, that study, the test, if you treat hearing loss, can we actually delay, can we help reduce the risk of cognitive decline dementia? It hasn't been done. And fortunately, that is a trial right now that we've been funded for the last couple years by the National Institutes of Health to plan and design. And just a few months ago, we submitted the grant to conduct this full-scale clinical trial to definitively test when we treat hearing loss, can we reduce the risk of cognitive decline dementia in older adults?
That is Dr. Frank Lin of Johns Hopkins Medicine here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about hearing loss. what can be done about it, what impacts it has. You can join the conversation if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm curious if you're finding it harder to understand conversations than it was for you a few years ago, and whether you've talked to your doctor about it, what you think the way forward for you is. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. You've led exactly to what I wanted to ask next, which is, you said, quote unquote, treat.
Mm-hmm.
What is treatment of hearing loss? We can't fix it, actually.
You're exactly right. So hearing impairment, by definition, basically means that for the vast majority of people, I should say, it means that there's been progressive damage to the cochlea, the part of the inner ear which actually takes in acoustic energy and converts it into a signal that goes to the brain. And over time, the cells in the cochlea are what we call post-mitotic, basically meaning they can't regenerate. So over a lifetime of exposure to noise, the effects of aging, possibly drugs, genetic risk factors or genetic predisposition, many of us, almost all of us, will lose some hearing loss as we age. And you're completely right. That type of hearing loss, what we call a sensorineural hearing loss, it cannot be reversed, right? So when we talk about treating hearing loss, what we're really talking about is not reversing hearing loss, but hopefully mitigating the effects of hearing loss on our ability to communicate effectively. So, you know, for the person with this, I would say a quote-unquote bread and butter, a mild to moderate hearing loss, which is the vast majority of older adults in their 70s, is that the mainstay of therapy are usually severalfold. One is, it sounds silly in a way, but just basic communication strategies, namely that if you have trouble hearing, you'll do a lot better if you're speaking face-to-face with that person, if your back's not turned to them when you talk, if you're trying to talk in a busy meeting hall, you step out into the hallway to talk, all those simple communication strategies can make all the difference. And yet they're hard to do because you're talking about fundamentally about changing your lifestyle a little bit, right? You know, placing yourself in a restaurant a little differently or avoiding certain restaurants. That's sort of like a lot of times probably the most important thing, which people sort of neglect a lot of times, are just basic behavioral communication strategies to communicate effectively. Beyond that, then, is when we start thinking about amplification, the classic one being hearing aids, right? Namely, when you use devices like hearing aids, it can provide, in many ways, an amplified, slightly louder signal, as well as helping to clean up that signal a little bit in terms of filtering out some of the background noise. So that usually is the mainstay of therapy right now for people with the bread and butter, I'll say the mild to moderate hearing losses, is a mix of just communication behavior strategies for how to communicate effectively, as well as using the right types of technology to allow for essentially a clear auditory signal, basically whether they be hearing aids or other types of devices they can use as well.
We need to take a short break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about devices that might help with hearing, but aren't really hearing aids per se. We're talking with Dr. Frank Lin of Johns Hopkins Medical about hearing loss, and you're welcome to join the conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Hearing loss affects tens of millions of Americans. The number of people coping with hearing loss doubles about every decade as we age, until after age 70, 2 out of 3 of us have a hearing challenge in communicating. We're talking this hour with Associate Professor Frank Lin of Johns Hopkins Medicine. His clinical practice is dedicated to the medical and surgical management of hearing problems, and his research focuses on the intersection of hearing loss, gerontology, and public health. We're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. I want to pick up where you left us before the break. We're talking about widespread incidents of hearing loss. We're talking mm-hmm. about hearing aids being the best thing we have for treatment right now, some kind of amplification in the mm-hmm. ear. So that would one would logically conclude then that these millions of people who have hearing loss are wearing hearing aids.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong.
No.
You laugh.
Unfortunately not. I mean, if we look at, and this figure hasn't changed in decades, amazingly, despite improvements in technology, improvements in our understanding of how hearing loss affects us. But we see about 20% of people, at most maybe 30% of people, who could likely benefit from using something as simple as a hearing aid are actually using it. And like I said before, that rate of use, 20-30%, it hasn't changed in literally decades.
Okay. Is this primarily because hearing aids are expensive? How expensive are they?
Yeah. So there's no doubt that cost is one of the big issues. And if you look at the average cost, per se, and the National Academies of Medicine recently looked at this issue, the average cost is about $4,700 to get fit with two hearing aids in the United States. And that was a few years ago.
And people generally need two?
Yeah,
most people have hearing loss in both ears.
I'll say cost is a primary paramount concern, but it's not the only one. The reason why I'll say this just in a breath is that if you go to many parts of Western Europe, Scandinavia, United Kingdom, where hearing aids are fully covered under their national health programs, their rates of hearing aid use are about 25-30%. So, I mean, a smidge higher than ours, don't get me wrong, but we're not talking 80-90% at all. I mean, it's nowhere even close. So the reason why I mentioned this to you is that I think cost is a critical issue, but there are many barriers to adoption of hearing care, of which cost is just one of them, and probably one of the more important ones, but definitely not the only one, though.
What are the others that you've identified?
So, cost is a big one, no doubt about it. But then there's a broader issue of even awareness and understanding, awareness that hearing loss, that yes, it is a usual process of aging, but it's not without consequence. Along with that, then, an understanding of what even constitutes hearing care. A lot of people say, oh, if I just get a hearing aid, I'll be cured, and then I'm fine. And that doesn't happen. So people get disappointed, and they throw the hearing aid in a drawer. So it's even understanding of what constitutes hearing care, what an audiologist is versus what a hearing instrument specialist is, what a hearing aid is versus what a portable sound, a personal sound amplifier is. I mean, all these terminology is very foreign even to other physicians. Along with that, there are much broader issues. This may be one of the more important ones, if you ask me, even more than cost, is the issue of access. Right now, the current gold standard in the United States and around the world, the only model of hearing healthcare, of accessing care for your hearing loss a lot of times, it's a clinic-based model where you go back and forth to an audiologist, you make a trip to get diagnosed, you make another trip to get fit for the hearing aids, make another trip to get the hearing aids fitted and adjusted. And that whole process can take months, literally months, and it costs a lot of money. So the idea that you have a mild, maybe early moderate hearing loss, but you can get by. You can squeeze by. The idea of having to commit that much time to go back and forth for a lot of times is unappealing unto itself. It's just it's not worth the effort per se. And finally, there are also some technical limitations as well of current technologies. But all of those combined, awareness, understanding issues, cost or affordability, I would say, access issues, as well as the technical limitations themselves, all sort of conspire to limit the adoption of hearing care. So it's not, a lot of times, not just one thing. If it was just one thing, it'd be probably easily solved. But it's an amalgam of several factors all contribute to this low rate of use.
We've got lots of people who want to be part of this conversation. Heather has called us from Parkton. Heather, welcome to Midday.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I was calling because I am 44 years old, and I have a moderate hearing loss in my left ear that was the result of trauma as a child. And a lot of what you've said has resonated with me about behavioral changes, because I am very conscious about where I sit next to someone that I'm speaking with. I have trouble in large rooms and big meetings. My ear, nose, and throat doctor has recommended a hearing aid to me, but I've resisted it subconsciously, I believe, for a few reasons. One, cost is certainly a factor, though I haven't looked into what it would cost. But I also sort of have this perception that hearing aids are for older people. Mm-hmm. And so I've been going along with the thought that I can adjust to my surroundings and I'm dealing with my hearing loss, though my husband would probably disagree somewhat. Mm-hmm. But I guess now that you've brought up all the health factors, my question is, should I reconsider that? And from a health perspective, am I better off getting it now instead of waiting?
So, Heather, I appreciate the question.
So, Heather, great question. I think your question really brings up sort of several issues. And hopefully I remember all of them to touch on. But I think the first one you mentioned is that, you said something to the fact that, I'm not sure if it was worth the hassle and, wasn't willing to make that commitment per se. And I think this really gets at the issue of access, because you're right. I mean, the only way technically right now you can access something as simple as a hearing aid is you need to make an appointment with audiologists and get fit and adjusted. And it takes multiple trips, where if you have a busy lifestyle, it may not be worth the commitment. And I think that is always the gold standard. Some people will need that level of care, but not everyone, right? And namely, I think what's
the level of care you're saying with an audiologist and fittings and probably multiple visits.
And I think what's evolving very rapidly now is this idea of having over-the-counter technologies available to someone like you, something you can literally program with your phone and you could adjust yourself and you could just use in that one ear, for instance. So that is what is happening now. And those technologies collectively are called personal sound amplifiers. A lot of times you'll see these ads in the back of magazines and newspapers. The unfortunate thing about that, though, is that some of those technologies are absolutely phenomenally good. They rival mid-level hearing aids in terms of their acoustic performance.
They cost a lot less.
Yeah, they cost on order of a couple hundred dollars usually.
Okay.
But the vast majority of those devices you see being advertised sold, though, are literally garbage. I mean, they're not acoustically beneficial at all. They may be, in many cases, maybe detrimental to your ability to understand and noise. But for the average consumer like you, Heather, it's hard distinguishing what would be a good over-the-counter technology versus what is not. And increasingly, that's another area my research group focused on, is actually testing some of these devices which are available over-the-counter and seeing which ones, in fact, are very, very good and which ones, in fact, aren't. And that's a whole separate thing we could touch on a little later. But there are some devices now that are very, very good, available over-the-counter, which you could literally purchase online and actually use, and acoustically, they're quite good. The second thing you touch on is the idea of is it easier to treat hearing loss earlier versus later? And as a general rule of thumb, it is, likely because there may in fact even be degradation of the auditory pathways that make it harder to treat someone's hearing loss when they've had hearing loss their entire lives versus just for a few years, for instance. I think you might be you probably don't need to worry about that too much, though. Namely, you're relatively young. Actually, I'd say you are young. And your hearing loss is only 1 year. So I don't think that argument necessarily applies for you. This is more for, let's say, say someone in my clinical practice, I'll see it's much easier addressing someone's hearing loss when it's a 70-year-old man who's had hearing loss maybe for 10, 15 years, slowly getting worse, as opposed to treating it when the guy is now 90 years old, now with a moderately severe, even severe hearing loss. It makes it much, much harder to address hearing loss at that point. But I think for you, that argument probably doesn't quite as well apply to you because you're, again, young and it's only in 1 year.
Heather, I really appreciate the call. Dr. Lin, since you brought it up, you said that there is research looking at which of these over-the-counter devices is good and which isn't. Is this research that Johns Hopkins has done?
It is. So it's actually one of my postdoctoral fellows, Nicholas Reed, who's now an instructor at Johns Hopkins, has done a lot of research in this, specifically actually testing these devices against each other, like electroacoustically, in terms of how they actually performed from their performance standards, as well as looking at people, how well they do with these devices versus, let's see, even a conventional hearing aid, how well they perform with understanding speech and noise. And he's actually found, again, a few of these devices are excellent and some are horrendously bad.
And is there a place where people who are interested, people like Heather, can find out what he has concluded about which ones are worth investing in?
You know, I should put this, you know, a lot of this research is essentially literally, quote-unquote, hot off the press. I mean, we've literally just been doing these experiments. They've been presenting. They've been they're coming onto literature right now. I'm always loath to sort of give an endorsement to a company
in the middle of radio ad.
But I will say then what we will do, and actually what my colleague Nick Reed now doing, is sort of building the patient help portal of my website, of our research group's website, where we do include a lot of this information actually. So we can give the website now or later.
Why don't you give it now, and then I'll get it from you, and we'll link to it from our website.
The website though is www.linresearch.org.
So that's Lin, linresearch.org. We will link to that from our website. We will also link to, we'll post later an article in the New York Times that quoted a few of the findings.
That's a great article, actually, that turned to.
That was from last month in the New York Times. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass talking with Dr. Frank Lin from Johns Hopkins about hearing loss and some of the ways to address it. Nate has called us from Baltimore. Nate, welcome to Midday.
Hello,
Nate. You're on the air.
Hi. So I've got hearing loss because I was in the military and I worked on jets for a certain amount of time. And now I work in a restaurant, like a really crowded restaurant. And I've definitely noticed that in addition to having hearing loss, I also have certain like memory loss problems. I felt at a time that I was suffering from early onset dementia, which is kind of unbelievable because I'm only 32. And I always attributed it to PTSD or something like that, but now hearing you talk, I think that maybe, you know, it's not PTSD and maybe it's something to do with hearing loss.
Go on.
I actually didn't have anything else. I'm sorry.
Well, I appreciate your raising it. Obviously, Dr. Lim can't diagnose you over the radio, but he might have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, so, you know, Nate, I empathize with what you're saying. I've seen a lot of sort of veterans who have come from abroad with, you know, essentially a marked hearing loss, which is likely only one of many things which can influence the symptoms you're having right now. One thing I'll just, I guess, let me just keep it brief, though, is the Veterans Administration actually, as busy as they are, their audiologic rehabilitative services, their hearing services are actually absolutely phenomenal. And a lot of times, once you get plugged in, you're in there for good, and it works really well. I know there are sometimes just barriers to getting access initially to those clinics, but I highly recommend. I mean, that might be a first place for you to start, though. They do an absolutely phenomenal job with hearing rehabilitation.
Nate, I really appreciate your calling. I wish you well in figuring this out. Mentioning the veterans healthcare system, the other thing that comes to my mind is it covers hearing aids, right? It supplies hearing aids to to veterans who are eligible for.
Yep, they're different. I think last time I looked, I think there are some different criteria depending on which region you're in and whether it has to be a service-related disability versus if it's not service-related, the severity it would be before they would cover it. But yes, absolutely, they do a phenomenal job of providing, you know, really truly comprehensive hearing rehabilitation services.
Medicare does not cover hearing devices. Why is that?
So it's fascinating, Sheila. So this is when CMS first came into law, basically in 1965. Center for Medicare Services or Medicare came into being in 1965. It was a statutory exclusion. Back then, the impression was that hearing is, again, a usual process of aging, that the therapies available for it were not very good necessarily, or if they were available, they were relatively low cost. I mean, this is really before the advent of even really good hearing aids, right? This is in the early 60s.
Oh.
So it was seen then as just it wasn't necessary. There was no reason for it. You know, I would say in 50 years, though, with our understanding of the impact of hearing loss, with the availability of technology, which are absolutely phenomenal, that all those arguments that were put into place in 1965 don't necessarily stand anymore for how CMS thinks about coverage for hearing rehabilitative services. But yeah, that was a statutory exclusion specifically written into law in 1965, which fortunately now I think is now coming more and more question, specifically because of work now coming from the National Academies of Medicine, which is looking at this issue, as well as even from the White House itself.
But hearing aids, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, are expensive. So it would be a big budget item if Medicare started to cover them. And presumably that would have some impact on what private insurers are under pressure to cover.
Right. So I think it gets on two questions. You're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of times CMS does play a big role influencing what private insurers cover, which is why it's almost hugely important to get sort of Medicare on board with this. Your question on the huge cost, though, is a complete legitimate one. And I say that it could be, but it doesn't have to be. And the reason why I say that right now is that we talked about this before briefly, but the cost of, quote-unquote, you know, getting two hearing aids is approximately $4,700, right? Which is, it's fairly absurd if you think about it. I mean, that means for the average American.
Absurd?
Yeah. I mean, that means for the average American, I mean, this could be your third largest purchase in life after a house and a car. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. I mean, $5,000 for the average American would literally be your third largest purchase life after a house and a car. And that's something that's not a one-time fixed cost. If you need new hearing aids every 5 years, I mean, it's a lot more than $5,000. But that ultimately, that cost, though, doesn't really represent the true cost of the hearing aid. So hearing aids traditionally, and 80% of places nowadays, are still sold as a bundled model. So when you pay that $4,700, literally two-thirds of that cost actually is the time to compensate the audiologists for their services, for their time, for providing you the fitting fee, the fitting and all the counseling you need to use that hearing aid well. Only about a third of the cost on average actually represents the true wholesale cost of the hearing aid that the audiologist has to pay themselves, right? Which calls into sort of a few questions, right? First of all, is $1,500 for a pair of hearing aids wholesale cost, quote, unquote, even reasonable, right? And I would say it's not. And the reason why it gets inflated so much is because there are a lot of sort of middlemen before the hearing aid even gets sold to an audiologist. You have inside sales rep, you have outside sales rep, you have a regional rep. So by the time an audiologist, and the average audiologist in the States probably only sells about 20 hearing aids per month, it's fundamentally a low volume, high margin market, right? Whereas if hearing aids were purchased in bulk, and this is what, for example, the Veterans Administration does, this is what they do with the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. When hearing aids are purchased in bulk orders, I mean, just, you know, with some scale, I mean, the average cost for a pair of hearing aids, for just the hearing aids themselves, is probably about $300. I mean, that's for a moderate to high-end hearing aid. The true cost when purchased in bulk is about $300, $400, right? But it's inflated even before it gets to audiologists because they don't buy in bulk, though, right? But the VA actually does. I mean, the VA's costs are probably somewhere around that range, too, as well. So $4,700, a third of that cost is the wholesale cost of hearing aid, which is already slightly inflated. The other two-thirds for the audiologist time, in many cases, really should be fully justified. If the audiologist is providing the services they should be doing in terms of something called real ear verification, making sure the hearings are fit properly, providing all the counseling and follow-up services, that cost is worth every penny of it. I think the issue with that model, though, is that, well, not everyone needs that level of service, though. Some people do, some people don't, right? So ultimately, in the end, some people are sort of supporting other people's needs who need more care, and other people who don't need much care are basically subsidizing that. So the model.
How do you know, though, what if you're someone with a hearing loss? How do you know whether you're somebody who needs a lot of care, or someone who will be pretty straightforward?
And that's the issue. You don't. So a big push now, I would say, among a lot of audiology societies now is to go for unbundling, where you unbundle, you itemize a cost. So it's just basically you're asking for basic transparency. So as a consumer, I know how much the hearing aid costs, right? So I can compare that cost I want. I know how much your professional services cost to fit me, to rehabilitate me for each visit, how much it's costing me. So you get an idea of actually what is involved in this process. Rather than thinking that the hearing aid is $5,000 and ridiculously expensive, it's actually not just the hearing aid, it's a lot of other service involved as well.
We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, we'll look more at how various hearing devices are regulated and continue to take your comments and questions about hearing loss. Have you ever wondered why we can buy fabulous cell phones with great hearing technology for a couple hundred dollars, but hearing aids cost 10 times that? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Frank Lin of Johns Hopkins. He's Associate Professor of Otolaryngology, which deals with hearing, and also Associate Professor of Geriatric Medicine, Mental Health, and Epidemiology. We're talking about new thinking of ways to regulate and distribute hearing aids. You can join the conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Curtis is calling us from Northwest Baltimore. Curtis, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a question. Has there been any studies done on professional musicians and, you know, people who I would say like myself are way past the 20,000-hour mark of listening to music constantly and working in a loud environment and hearing loss and dementia? I'm just trying to get an idea because that was very interesting to hear, you know, although correlation is not causation, but hearing loss and dementia associated in the same sentence. And I just want to know what I have to look forward to in my life.
Curtis, I appreciate the question. I had the same reaction to hearing about Dr. Lin's research.
So Curtis, great question. I don't know of any research that's specific to the direct interplay of musicians, hearing loss, and dementia. I mean, pairwise. And what I mean by that, we've looked at sort of just hearing loss in general and dementia. there's actually some literature also looking at people with early musicality and musical ability, and their risk of dementia might be slightly lower. Maybe we don't really know why, but nothing looking at the interplay sort of hearing loss, musicians, and dementia. Now, the other pairwise sort of comparison, there was obviously hearing loss in musicians, and yeah, there's undoubtedly we know that with long periods of noise exposure, you're more likely to develop hearing loss as any of us age, but in particular for musicians with a sustained a lifetime exposure to loud noise too, that they're also likely more at risk as well.
Curtis, thank you. Good luck. Amanda is calling us from Frederick. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Just great.
So I have a question. My daughter has moderate hearing loss, and I wanted to see how much studies you guys have done in cognitive learning and memory capability in children. Because I know that I've seen research from the University of California, and she actually does have some issues in school, and I wanted to see how much of that is being studied so that way kind of helps in the school programs and the teachers in learning new ways to be able to adjust or teach them due to their hearing loss.
Yeah, great question, Amanda. So fortunately, that is an area which has received a tremendous amount of research going back now literally decades now, where, you know, I would say 30, 40 years ago, people sort of just, again, even just poo-pooed hearing loss in kids. It doesn't really matter that much. But then later beginning 20, 30 years ago, there was just a huge amount of research looking at the impact that hearing loss could have on a child's ability to engage well in school, to learn incidentally on the playground, to hear the teacher, things like that. We now know that hearing loss plays a substantial role in kids' ability to perform well in school. So fortunately, there is a tremendous amount of research there, which is why fortunately now, you know, many states that hearing aids are actually fully covered for children.
Amanda, thank you. Good luck with sorting this out. We got an email from Anne who says, I went to a clinic to get my ears checked and was told my hearing was fine, but I know I don't hear as well as my husband. My dad and grandmother both had serious hearing issues. How do I get diagnosed, and what type of hearing aids should I get? My dad had digital ones. I still have them, although they are 8 years old now. Can they be updated for me?
Great question. So usually the first stop, I would say, is get in terms of diagnosis, is following up with an audiologist. So audiologists are clinical doctorates who are trained to diagnose and to address and treat hearing loss. Depending on, usually with a physician's referral, almost a visit to audiologist will always be covered in terms of the diagnostic audiogram, and the diagnostic testing is almost always covered by insurance. So that would without a doubt be the first with a first stop, just getting a diagnosis and seeing your pattern of hearing loss and what may be involved there. The second question you brought up about your father's hearing aids, 8 years old, could they be used for you? Possibly. In many cases, hearing aids can last, you know, far longer than just a few years. But the key thing there is that hearing aids are typically sort of programmed to be fitted for your pattern of hearing loss. And that's key, obviously, because obviously you're just like you want to use your father's glasses. They need to be refit for you. But usually, yes, any audiologist, for the most part, as long as they use that type of technology, could likely reprogram the hearing aid for you if that's what you needed.
Thank you for the call. We have talked in this hour about I sort of think of it as two kind of big approaches to hearing aids. I mean, one is the gold standard audiologist, multiple fittings, a hearing aid just for me that's fitted quite well. And then we've talked about over the counter. The first is pretty expensive. The second, you said you can invest in something that's crap. There isn't that much research, although you're starting to do some on kind of which ones are good. So, what's the way forward?
Yeah, great question.
Where do you see this going?
So the issue with the reason why there's so many bad devices that are over-the-counter is because there's essentially no regulation in this area. It's sort of a free-for-all. The way hearing aids are regulated in the States is that they are a medical device. A tongue depressor is a medical device, literally. I mean, those are all FDA-regulated devices.
A piece of wood that depresses the tongue is a medical device.
It's an FDA-regulated device, absolutely. But the way the FDA regulates hearing aids, though, is a little different. As the FDA does not specifically state that hearing aids can be sold over-the-counter. They just say they're regulated devices, they're subject to special controls, basically there are certain criteria they hit, which is fine. Because there's a little ambiguity, though, in terms of whether they can be over-the-counter per se, which FDA never says, is at the state level, then every single state licensing board says, well, these are medical devices, and hence these medical devices can only be sold through a licensed provider, namely an audiologist, a hearing instrument specialist, and in most states, a physician could also sell one too, right? So that basically means you literally cannot buy a hearing aid over the counter. You can't, right? But, and here's the big
but. So the things you were talking about buying over the counter are not hearing aids.
They're not hearing aids. They are what's called a personal sound amplifier. So what's the difference, right? The difference is all about how you label it. So literally, you could take a $5,000, quote-unquote, $5,000 hearing aid, and you could literally just erase the labeling on the box and no longer call it a hearing aid, but say it's a personal sound amplifier that's not specifically intended for hearing loss, doesn't treat hearing loss, and all of a sudden, you can sell that same device over the counter, right? So what that basically means then is that the way what these devices are called now collectively are called personal sound amplifier, right? Or PSAPs, personal sound amplifier products, PSAPs. And some of these are very much legitimately not for hearing loss. They're the devices that you would wear when you go hunting, for instance, if you want to be able to hear better when you're hunting, for instance, hunter's ears and things like that. But increasingly, how some companies are devising their products is they want to provide an over-the-counter technology, right? They can't call it a hearing aid. So instead, they have to call it a PSAP, a personal sound amplifier product. But they can't label it a certain way. They can't say it's treating hearing loss. They can't say it's meant for hearing loss. They can only say that it amplifies ambient sounds and is meant for people with normal hearing, whatever that means. So there's a lot of regulatory uncertainty now for how these devices are approached, which is why there's such a mess in the marketplace now because of this essentially this quagmire right now of how the regulatory standards work.
So the FDA is the federal agency that would regulate. I mean, could it set standards for these personal devices?
So fortunately, I think that is the direction it's going now, Sheila. It's like the Food and Drug Administration last year, or a year and a half ago, they were a co-sponsor for the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. They commissioned the National Academy of Medicine, essentially, to examine this very issue. How can we bring about more affordable and accessible hearing healthcare? And there are other sponsors as well. But the FDA was actually one of the co-sponsors of that initiative. And the report just came out formally this past June from the National Academies of Medicine. I was actually one of the members of the committee. As well as in parallel with a completely independent initiative, the White House actually also looked at this issue specifically. The President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology also looked at this issue of how do we bring out more accessible hearing care for Americans. And in parallel, these two parallel independent initiatives basically came to the same conclusion, is that the FDA needs to create a separate regulatory category specific for over-the-counter devices. So being whether you call it a hearing aid or a hearing device, but something over-the-counter that be labeled as meant and intended to address hearing loss, but could be specifically sold over-the-counter. So that would bring regulatory clarity to this marketplace that you had that certain standard, so you couldn't literally have junk on the marketplace anymore if they're going to be calling themselves an over-the-counter hearing device. And that is very key. And I think, fortunately, it seems to be moving ahead. The FDA convened the first of probably many planned meetings earlier this year. And my understanding now is that there are probably many to follow. The FDA is probably beginning to look at this issue to create a separate category to essentially bring the regulations, which were established many years ago, literally in 1977, back into the current present right now, where technologies have changed tremendously in terms of what's possible.
Rob has called us from Arnold, Maryland. Rob, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I just got my hearing aids about a month ago, and I was really amazed at the difference. And I was impressed with the digital quality, how they could actually tweak the different sounds. And it wasn't just a matter of amplification. It was actually there were different notes that I was missing. I have a really good friend who's on welfare, and she can't afford hearing aids. Mm-hmm. I heard that there might be some foundations that could help her.
I don't know whether you're aware of that. Is that something you can tell?
Not an easy answer, Rob, in one sentence. There are a lot of options, all of which are sort of a patchwork of things. Sertoma, which is a service organization, they sort of have different programs for that. Something called the Star Key Here Now Foundation has something as well. Again, we'll have the website available, and we provide all those resources on the website as well.
And the website we're going to link to, again, is www.linresearch.org. That's linresearch.org. So we don't have that link up yet, but we will get it up, Rob. Maureen has called us from Timonium. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm calling in to share my story with sudden sensory neural hearing loss, which led to me getting a Baha, a bone-anchored hearing appliance. On March 17th, 2007, fortunately I was home. Suddenly I had vertigo, fullness in the ear, dizziness and all. I already had an ENT because I had sinus problems before. I went in, he tested me, and I had severe to profound loss in my right ear. I went through the oral prednisone. I went through the steroid injections into the eardrum, and he fitted me with hearing aids. And the reason I like to share my story about how I got the Baha, the bone-anchored hearing appliances, because he did not suggest at all the Baha. I learned about the Baha from another civilian who happened to have one, you know, stuck on the side of his head, and I said, what's that? And he told me all about it. I looked into where I could get this done and went to GBMC, got implanted with a Baha January 2010. And you talk about cost, insurance paid surgery, implant, abutment, but not $5,000 for the sound processor. Fortunately, I could pay for that, although I wasn't happy about it. I gave up with the going around with the insurance company. Now, because the sound is sent through my skull, it's actually sent to my left ear, where I have excellent hearing for my age. I'm in my late 50s. But it's definitely a real problem that people need to know that there's help out there.
Maureen,
I appreciate. Yeah, if the civilian hadn't said something, my ENT didn't even suggest it.
Maureen, I appreciate you letting us know about this. We have just a few minutes left. So, Dr. Lin, any comment?
Just briefly, you know, I think that what you're getting is that there's been a plethora of now of different devices which can be used for hearing loss. Yours is a little more unique, just a unilateral one-sided hearing loss. But yeah, things like the Baha and other technologies are available. A lot of times, just finding the right provider who's familiar with these different technologies.
Maureen, thank you for calling us. We got an email from Stan, who says, if I'm understanding correctly, that even someone who's not a veteran can go to Walter Reed. Stan writes, retired veterans can get a pair of top-quality hearing aids for about $850 by going to Walter Reed Audiology Clinic. They will make you pay the government cost they provide to other services. The program is RACHAP, and Stan offers to answer questions. If people email us, we can put you in touch with Stan. Have you heard of this?
I have not, but that's wonderful to hear, though. I mean, that's why I think there's a lot of regional variability in terms of the VA programs, and that sounds like maybe a relatively unique program, Walter Reed, but that's phenomenal to know about, though, because they do a phenomenal job with hearing rehabilitation.
So we will look into this, and if there's something we can post on our website, we will do that. We're down to a half minute. Is there a closing thought that you – we've covered so much territory, and I'm not sure what I think about how things are going to work going forward.
You know, Maureen, Sheila, I'll just say in the last breath, I think fortunately now we talk about always been barriers to hearing healthcare before, and I think finally things are beginning to change, again, with actions coming now from, again, the National Academy of Medicine and directly from the White House. Is that for the first time in history now, we're seeing a tremendous amount of top-down initiative to address all these barriers, whether it's affordability, cost, access, technology, FDA. But I think finally now we are beginning to address society.
I really appreciate you spending the hour with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Sheila.
Dr. Frank Lin is Associate Professor of Otolaryngology and of Geriatric Medicine, Mental Health, and Epidemiology. He has led groundbreaking research on the extent and impact of hearing loss. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. More than 90% of foundation CEOs are white. Our guests say the lack of diversity within these organizations leads to a lack of moral urgency. Is there a need for black rage in philanthropy? What would that look like? That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.